This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Let's start. Times of Possibilities. First lecture, Subjects and Citizens, the Possibility Condition, Law and Democracy. There'll be three sections. Section one. So this section is just to lay out what I mean by the possibility condition in early modern thought. Okay, so possibility is one of a series of features of law that had originally been laid down by St. Isidore of Seville in book two of his Etymologies, composed around 630 CE. So here's the key passage from book two, chapter 10. This is my translation. A law shall be honest, just, possible, according to nature, according to the custom of the country, appropriate to time and place, necessary, useful, also clear, so that it doesn't contain anything that might tend to trick through obscurity, written to no private advantage but for the common profit of the citizens. Now, that passage was incorporated into canon law by Gratian in the Decretum, and it's made its way into the later scholastic tradition through Thomas Aquinas, specifically question 95 of the Prima Secunda, which discusses the nature of human law, that is, the positive law of political communities. Now, Article 3 of question 95 asks whether Isidore had rightly described what Aquinas initially called the qualities of law. But he made it clear that he understood these as conditions of law, without which law is not properly law. So, concerning the conditions possible according to nature, according to the customs of the country, Thomas interpreted as follows. Discipline, moral training, disciplina in the Latin, must be appropriate to each according to his own possibility. Paying heed to the possibility of nature, for the same things are not to be imposed on boys as on mature men. And it must be according to human custom, for a man cannot live alone in society, not behaving like other people. Now, before I continue with the exegesis, I'll pause here for a moment to consider Isidore's text and Aquinas' gloss in relation to modern translations of these passages. So it's worth noticing that the 2006 Cambridge translation of the Etymologies reads that very differently. So it thinks that there are three entirely separate conditions: enforceable, natural, in keeping with the custom of the country. So it's translating possible as enforceable. Other scholars of Isidore render it as feasible or practical. Now, the standard Blackfriars translation of the quotation of Isidore in Thomas's Summa does have possible to nature according to the custom of the country, so it makes it two conditions rather than three, but it keeps the language of possibility. But in the body of the article, the translation loses the word possibility and talks about ability instead. And jumping ahead to the parallel article of the early modern Spanish Jesuit scholastic Francisco Suarez in his De Legibus on the Laws of 1612, the translation opts for practicable as a translation of possible, although the translator's note does suggest that its literal meaning is possible as impossible to observe. So those few references can serve to illustrate the tendency of possibility to kind of get lost in translation, to disappear into something less existential and more pragmatic, and that's something I shall return to later on. Meanwhile, returning to Aquinas in question 95, article 3. So Aquinas here interprets nature as the constitution of the individual, the difference between a child and an adult. He gives no specific example of what you cannot impose on a child as you would on an adult, but the example Suarez uses of that differential capacity is the capacity to endure fasting, a fast in Lent. And Aquinas does use that example in the Secunda Secunda, so it may well indeed be what he had in mind. So fasting, that's an act in the virtue of temperance, and it crosses between physical capacity and psychological capacity. By contrast, custom in Aquinas is taken as the habitual collective behaviour of plurality, which it's impossible for an individual to go against. So that's the terrain of what we might call the psychosocial, a domain in which, although the possibility might be strictly speaking individual, actually it's not, because of the way that individual behaviour necessarily takes its cue from the customary forms of community practice. So that sense of possibility is quite fluid already in Aquinas when he introduces the term. Now, Aquinas was also introduced with a kind of collective possibility according to nature, not quite the same as the psychosocial that we've just been establishing. This is the capacity for virtue generalized across the whole community. And he made this plain in his question whether law can prohibit all the vices. So here he's not talking about physical possibility. It's not about the psychosocial, although there's an interesting interface with that. It's a different kind of psychological possibility, that is, the capacity for virtue generalized across a multitude of people. And this is a kind of possibility to which, as we'll see shortly, the Counter-Reformation scholastics gave a name. So Aquinas argues here that law has to, what I call, legislate down to the capacity for virtue that's generalized across a multitude, not just for particular individuals who might be very virtuous and might be able to manage something more, but what most people can manage. And therefore, you can't legislate for too high a level of virtue and still expect it to be obeyed. So putting all these things together, the possibility condition in Aquinas is a serious break on what can humanly be legislated. So standardly in interpretations of Aquinas' thought, two conditions are seen as essential for human law. First, that it's in accordance with natural law, because otherwise it's unjust and it fails the basic conditions of law. And second, that it be for the common good. So two poles, in accordance with natural law, for the common good of the political community. But what we can now see is that the possibility condition is a critical interface between those two, an interface between, if you like, the moral demands of natural law and the common good that is secured by human law. So possibility is a space of negotiation between the characteristics of ruled and the purposes of the legislator. And there's agency on both sides in creating a law that holds that middle ground effectively and is therefore conducive to the common good of all. Now, Aquinas' handling of possibility in this question on whether law can prohibit all the vices brings it close to a second author from antiquity who deployed possibility as a condition of law, not quite in those terms, but he's another key early modern source for this idea. So this is Plutarch of Chaeronea, writing his parallel lives of the Greeks and the Romans in the 2nd century CE. And here we're interested in the life of the Athenian lawgiver Solon. So several of Solon's legislative innovations are presented, I think, by Plutarch in a similar light. But the question of psychological possibility explicitly comes out in the discussion of the fines that Solon laid down for getting angry in a public place. So he says, for never to master one's anger is a mark of intemperance and lack of training, but always to do so is for many difficult and to some impossible. And law must be formulated with regard to the possible if its maker wishes to punish a few to some purpose rather than many to no purpose. So there is simply no point in legislating for something that's too hard for most people to manage. All you'll do is end up punishing a lot of people uselessly. And that's not what the law is about. So Plutarch's Lives provided a second channel through which possibility as a condition of law filters through to the Renaissance and early modern period. So here it is in Thomas North's translation. So this is from 1579. It was extraordinarily popular. Now, North was translating not from Plutarch's original, but from the French translation of Jacques Amyot. So he was a French clergyman of the mid-16th century. And I think that his translation, see how he refers not just to the possible, but to the common possibility of men, that common possibility generalized. In the French, it's selon l'ordinaire possibilité des hommes. And I think that shows clear signs of the Counter-Reformation articulation of the possibility in Aquinas in terms of something that they call moral possibility. So very briefly, so we're now moving into the Counter-Reformation. So what are they arguing against? So briefly, it's central to Reformation theology that it's impossible, even for the just, to obey God's law. And still more impossible for fallen man, of course, but even for the just, God's law is impossible. And it's precisely because they cannot obey the law, it's impossible for them, that they are therefore justified by faith alone and not by works. Now, in response, the Counter-Reformation argues that the Reformation doctrine that God commands the impossible, that makes God into a tyrant. He commands the impossible and then he punishes man with damnation, fallen man with damnation, for failing to obey. And the standard biblical reference that they use is from the book of Exodus, and this is Pharaoh. So Pharaoh commands the Israelites to make bricks at the same rate as they did before without giving them any straw. And when they fail, he punishes them for doing it. So that is pharaonic tyranny. That is the classic locus for commanding the impossible. And they say the reformers make God into a pharaoh. Now, in Exodus, the impossibility is, let's say, physical or even logical. There's a fine line between physical impossibility and logical self-contradiction, which we might come back to. But anyway, it's impossible in the sense that the Israelites cannot make bricks. Let's call it physical. They cannot physically make bricks at the same rate as before if they're not given any straw and they have to search for it themselves. But of course, the impossibility of not sinning is not physical. It's psychological. Because clearly it's not physically impossible for fallen man to obey God's law, nor is it logically impossible. It's not a self-contradiction. But Counter-Reformation theologians didn't want to say that it's straightforwardly possible either, because that's Pelagianism, and that's precisely what the reformers are accusing them of. So their response is to say that it's morally impossible. That is, they argue, given the degree of psychological propensity or habituation to sin in fallen man, it's just too difficult to resist sinning over a sustained period of time. Now, that maneuver allowed them to say that God does not command the impossible, even of fallen man, right? Because a sinner might, on a good day, so if he wakes up, rise and shine, he might manage to obey the commandments for, you know, half an hour. Maybe even a whole morning if it's a really good day. But he's not going to manage it for very long, let alone every day or every week or for the whole of his life. So it's morally impossible, but it's not absolutely impossible. And as a difference from the reformers, they want to argue that precisely because God's law is not impossible, God in a way legislates down to the capacity of ordinary people, it is actually possible for the just to obey the law. And therefore the just are justified by their works, not only by their faith. Okay, so moral possibility, a very distinctive concept. It sandwiches together the idea of psychological difficulty. Moral impossibility, psychological easiness. I think I should say moral impossibility. Moral impossibility is a distinctive concept sandwiching together the idea of psychological difficulty and in frequency. Something is morally impossible if it's both very hard and it doesn't happen very often. And what we get with the Counter-Reformation scholastics is a transference of this idea to the possibility condition on human law. So they inject this sense of psychological possibility into Aquinas' discussion. So what they now argue is that the law, human law, has to be morally possible. That is, psychologically not too difficult over the run of the population and for a considerable stretch of time. Importantly, in the space of human law, possible according to nature, if you remember Aquinas' original discussion, is taken not centrally for fallen man, that's the kind of possibility that's relevant to divine law, but for healthy human nature, which has inclinations and appetites to what's genuinely good. And the governing text is jugum suave, the easy yoke. Suave, sweet, sometimes in early modern English, but here's the translation from the Authorized Version. This is Christ's words: my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And that is everywhere. And if Christ legislated for an easy yoke, well, how much the more the human legislator who is not Christ. Translated from the law of Christ to human law, moral possibility is understood as a condition of law that governs a citizen as opposed to the commands of a master over a slave. So here is the contrast between citizenship and slavery in the words of Francisco Suarez's exact contemporary and close associate, Juan de Salas. So if you look down to, so there are various kinds of moral impossibility in relation to divine law and relation to human law, but coming down halfway down that paragraph, even concerning the second kind of impossibility, i.e. a thing that's very difficult or heavy and burdensome, there can be no human commands, at least when there's not the most grave and urgent cause. Because, end of that paragraph, human beings are not subject to their princes in a servile manner as slaves, but politically as citizens. So it's precisely the mark of a slave that they're compelled to the morally impossible, and like the Israelites in Egypt. And it's tyranny to transfer that kind of subjection into the political domain. So the law has to be easy for you in the sense that you can do it without too much difficulty. Now, it's important that this concept was applicable beyond the confines of Counter-Reformation moral theology. So here, I think, is an example from the Italian Protestant exile in Elizabethan England. This is Alberico Gentili. He's not using that specific language, but I think it's what he's talking about. So here he's enthusiastically defending the Roman law of slavery against the thoroughgoing critique of Jean Baudin. So what Gentili wants to say here is, you know, this is the master-slave relationship is legal, right? It's within Roman law. It's not extra legal. So it's governed by justice. But slavery means that you can legally be forced to do what's repugnant to your inclinations, right? These illiberal, servile duties as opposed to liberal duties. And he concludes by saying, one no longer has the right, this is a standard English translation, to have the sentiments of a free man who can no longer regard himself as free. So what he's basically saying, I think, is that the moral possibility condition does not apply to a slave. That's why slavery is so bitter. And notice the classic response to such a command across the run of early modern thought, despair. So the Spartan boy kills himself. Okay, going back to Isidore, recall that a law has to be possible both according to nature and according to custom. And notice the interface between the two in this example from Gentili. So the idea of what's psychologically possible humanly and psychologically possible because of what you think a free man ought to do, that's a very fine line. And scholastics were very sophisticated on that interface between the natural and the customary, as indeed was early modern thought more generally. So we want to call this the humanly possible. It's somewhere between the naturally possible and the kind of customarily or socially possible. And that language of the human is increasingly used to describe this kind of possibility. But scholastic theologians were also interested in more everyday examples. It's not just about slavery and extreme assault on one's feelings. So customary possibilities. So, for example, if you're used to going on to market on Tuesday, so Tuesday is market day, and your prince suddenly legislates to change it to Thursdays, well, that's a bit much. I mean, you know, maybe you have all sorts of other things you do on a Thursday, right? You're going to have to give them up. You're going to have to give up your yoga class. I don't know. You've organized your life around this, all right? And as it's sort of understood as a textured social life lived with others, and it's not the function of government to make life difficult for you in this way. Okay, so legislative change is a key site for possibility arguments and possibility protests, and I'll come back to that in the next lecture. Meanwhile, what's attractive about this? Well, at least what do I think is attractive? I like the way that it's embedded in the way that people live their lives. Yes, they're natural psychology, but it's that interface between the natural and the social, who you are in that kind of social context. In the early modern iteration, it's got a very strong ethnographic component, and again, I'll return to that in the next lecture. But I don't think it reduces to that. So I think it takes very seriously the emotional attachment of people to their distinctive forms of life. And it takes also very seriously and sympathetically the kind of investment that they have, therefore, in the kind of material supports of that. Your house, your goods, all sorts of things that to which you are strongly attached in the way that you are attached to your life itself. It's not entirely non-judgmental, but it's quite generous in taking people pretty much as they come. Moral possibility is also very sensitive to social differentiation within the community. So it recognizes that people of different social statuses will be attached to different things. And I think there's no denying that this has a politically very conservative, some might say reactionary, edge. So a standard example is that certain things are impossible for aristocrats, like working in the fields. Right, so that's morally impossible. So it'd be tyrannical to force an aristocrat go and dirty his hands in the fields, particularly if there was a peasant available to do it instead. So I don't want to sort of suggest that this is some progressive idiom. It isn't. It can be quite reactionary. So it's embedded in the estate society of early modern Europe, entrenched social stratification. And we'll come to it again next lecture. So dishonor, for example, is something psychologically impossible for someone of a certain status. And so to be forced into something dishonorable, that is a point at which you might resist. But I don't think that this way of thinking inherently privileges aristocrats over the rest. In a way, they've got more to lose. So it kind of lines up with them a bit more. But it's also worried about tax burdens on the poor, driving the poor to desperation. So it does cover people of lower status as well. And again, I'll return to that in the next lecture. So this kind of approach has something in common with sociological approaches to law. So I think it's got an obvious successor in Montesquieu, L'Esprit des Lois. Law not as an abstract rule, but as a form of social organization that needs to be assimilated into their everyday lives, by the people that it governs, creating a kind of reciprocity between the legislator and the citizens. But unlike a pure sociology of law, the possibility condition in early modern scholastic thought has a very political edge, precisely because it's associated with a distinctive conception of citizenship and rights against the law. So I'll return to that in the final section of this lecture. Section 2. Okay, now, so for the middle section of this lecture, I want to contrast this version of the possibility condition with a 20th century iteration, I think, of the same thing in the hands of the American legal philosopher Lon Fuller. So in his celebrated book, The Morality of Law, first published in 1964, Fuller prefaced his second chapter, which is called Morality That Makes Law Possible, with a quotation from a 17th century English common lawyer, quote, "A law which a man cannot obey nor act according to it is void and no law, and it's impossible to obey contradictions and to act according to them." And he ended the chapter with another quotation, this time from Thomas Jefferson, decrying laws that attempt to compel the conscience. "Well aware," this is Jefferson, quoted by Fuller, "that the opinions and beliefs of men depend not upon their own wills, but follow involuntarily the evidence proposed to their minds. So it's actually impossible for them to believe other than they do." And Fuller suggested that Jefferson's indictment of laws compelling the conscience as impossible laws, violations of the possibility condition, was a stronger and more profound argument than the present-day condemnation of the same thing on the grounds of unwarrantable interference with individual liberty. So Fuller is quite invested, I think, in the possibility condition in an early modern sense. And I think actually he was historically very perceptive in his understanding of how the possibility condition had permeated broader legal thinking towards the end of the 17th century and into the 18th. So the possibility condition had a Protestant as well as a Catholic reception. So the Dutch jurist Hugo Grotius is a key channel for its modulation into Protestant jurisprudence. So in general, the 17th century Protestant reception tends to naturalize and to individualize the question of possibility. So it's more possible according to nature rather than the rich social context that characterizes the Catholic reception. But his insight into religious liberty as a possibility argument, I think, is supported by current research. So it's not the theme of this lecture, but I think that the Protestant diffusion of the possibility condition is actually one of the key vehicles for the transformation of natural rights into human rights between the 17th and the 18th centuries. So already in the 16th and 17th centuries, the tyranny of imposing the impossible is distinctively associated with the language of the inhuman and the cruel. And that's back to this idea that moral possibility is what's humanly possible. Meanwhile, as these bookends to his key chapter suggest, Fuller was much impressed by the idea that the law cannot command the impossible. And he uses that language of possibility throughout his discussion. But here's another place where, if you find Fuller summarized in the literature, possibility tends to be replaced by practicable and practicability. A law has to be practical, practicable. But as with the earlier tradition, I think we get a richer sense of Fuller if we put that more existential sense of possibility back in. Okay, so here is a very celebrated episode from Fuller's work, and it's he describes this hapless King Rex who legislates for the people and keeps getting things wrong. So there are 8 failures of this hopeless king. And I leave you to read them. We are interested in 5 and 6. Actually, we're interested in the whole lot, but 5 and 6, the enactment of contradictory rules, or 6, rules that require conduct beyond the powers of the affected party. Now, interestingly, a footnote to this passage acknowledges that self-contradiction might be thought to be a subset of impossibility, right? So, because it's impossible to obey a self-contradictory law, so why don't the two collapse into one? But Fuller said that was a kind of a logician's point, and he rejected it with the argument that From the legislator's perspective, avoiding self-contradictory laws and avoiding laws that are beyond people's power to obey are two different things. So, the logician. But we're not talking about that. We're talking from the point of view of the legislator. So, Fuller's treatment of the possibility condition and the self-contradiction, I said, but listen, here we're essentially interested in the possibility condition, seemingly excludes a key element of the early modern understanding of it, which is what I call the subject's eye viewpoint. So it's not just the legislator legislating what he thinks, or she, if it's Queen, thinks is possible. The subject also has a view on what's possible for them. And I argue that that subject's eye viewpoint is key to constituting the field of the possible in early modern scholastic thought. So here is Suarez, and this is a chapter that we had before, differentiating between two different standpoints from which we can say that a law is just. So obviously a law has to be just, but that's not the end of the story. There's justice as legislated, and there's justice as performed by the subject. So the question of justice is, quote, may be viewed from the standpoint of the very act which the subject is, by virtue of the said law, obliged to perform. That is to say, the act must be such that it may justly be executed by him. Secondly, it may be considered in regard to the law itself. That is, the law must be imposed upon men without the infliction of injury. Now, Suarez's example of the way those two can pull apart is a possibility argument. Well, in this case, an impossibility argument. So this is a fast in bread and water for the whole of Lent. I think the whole of Lent might be Gabriel Vasquez sort of riffing on this. But anyway, a fast in bread and water for a considerable period of time. So that's an impossible law. Most people cannot manage that. So that would be unjustly imposed by the legislator. So it's an unjust law. But if a subject can manage it, well, it wouldn't be injustice for the subject to obey the law after all. So my point here is that possibility from the point of view of the legislator and, sorry, that justice from the point of view of the legislator and the subject can pull apart. And although Suarez gives you an example of impossibility to characterize that, it's not actually just an example. Possibility is the central case of the split between the legislative perspective and the subject's eye viewpoint. Now, I argued that the Catholic scholastic iteration of the possibility condition is more sort of richly socially textured than the kind of early modern Protestant iterations to which Fuller is indebted. And when Fuller comes to talking about the possibility condition and what he means by that, it is strikingly less rich than someone like Suarez. I think it's even less rich than, e.g., someone like Jefferson or his English 17th century common lawyers. So quite a lot of it is about legal liability. That is, how can the law make a person liable for an action when it might have been impossible for them to avoid? So it's really quite a strictly legal understanding of it. Nevertheless, Fuller did allow for what the scholastics would call possible according to nature. So that is within an individual's natural capacity or power to perform. Again, it's very individualized. There's nothing of the psychosocial really substantively. But his main point here is that impossibility could in fact mean an impossibility for the legislator, not for the subject. So he thought that there was a kind of uncrossable divide between the possibility that the law presupposes and the impossibility that might be experienced by any individual citizen. So the law takes a generic account of what, you know, what a standard person would be able to manage. But maybe that particular person couldn't manage it because of their nature or their education. Maybe the law was actually impossible for that person. So I think Fuller, too, in his way, identifies the distinctive way in which possibility can cause the law as legislated and the law as obeyed to split apart. And this is what I'm calling the possibility gap. So for him, he described this as an antinomy that could not be transcended within law. So you'll see, he says at the end, the result is that an aloof justice is bound at times to be harsh, and intimate justice, which pays attention to individual possibility, cannot be even-handed. And Fuller thought you simply couldn't solve that. He called it an insoluble dilemma. The law had to steer a kind of uncertain middle course between the two. So the law cannot close the possibility gap. I think that's the point of Fuller. Now, so what is impossible? Now, here Fuller is very like the scholastics. So he's arguing here that there's no hard and fast line between extreme difficulty and impossibility. So as you say, he says a rule that asks somewhat too much, a bit much, can be harsh and unfair, but it need not contradict the basic purposes of a legal order, as does a rule that commands what is patently impossible. Between the two is another indeterminate area in which the internal moralities and the external moralities of law meet. Now, in saying this, Fuller was still looking from the legislative viewpoint. But as I've suggested, that was not the only point of view relevant to the question of possibility in the early modern period. So in the face of impossibility, early modern theologians from across the confessional divide argued that the subject has a choice. So this is Girolamo Zanchi, who was a reformed divine, so he's Calvinist, but he's key in bringing the Thomist tradition of legal thinking into Calvinist theology. So possibility as a condition of human law is not purely a Catholic phenomenon. Okay, so everyone at the time agreed that if a law is unjust in the sense of going against God's law, a private subject is bound to disobey. So you must always obey God before man. Now, at the extreme, a case of impossibility might fall into that bracket. So a command to kill yourself is the standard example of something that's extremely morally repugnant, impossible in that sense, but also against the law of God, right? It's suicide. That's suicide. That's against natural law. So at that point, you could be bound to disobey. If a legislator commanded you to kill yourself, you could be bound to disobey. But for the most part, and we've already seen this with Suareth, laws that violate the possibility condition, like the fast and bread and water for the whole of Lent, they're ones that don't involve you in sin if you disobey them, right? It's perfectly possible to fast in bread and water, and it might even be praiseworthy. So they just involve considerable pain and cost to yourself. So what we're really interested in here is impossibility short of the extreme. I think that's the category that's politically interesting. That's the grey area in which your material interests and your concerns, what you stand to lose by obeying, are precisely relevant to the question of whether you have to obey or not. So it's here that subjects have their agency against the law. Here is where the possibility condition gets political, a matter of citizenship. So this is an individual, right? Am I or am I not obliged to obey this particular law? And the casuistry of individual obligation is a key site for possibility arguments in early modern thought. We find it across the confessional divide, across the domains of theology and of law. And it's often characterized by a crossover between arguments for possibility and arguments for equity, Right, so tempering of the law in particular circumstances. And I think that crossover between equity and possibility is a part, key part of its story of its assimilation into the kind of common law jurisprudence that Fuller was interested in. Now, Lorraine Daston, in an enjoyable and suggestive recent book called Rules, A Short History of What We Live By, which I recommend to you, she identifies casuistry, equity, and exception as the early modern iterations of what she calls thick rules. So a thin rule, not a thick rule, is one that just says do this or do that. But casuistry or equity is a thick rule and it says, well, do this, except that in the circumstances you don't have to. You could do something else. So it's thick with exceptions and this and that and the other to get a better fit between the ruler and the person who obeys it. So I find her defense of thick rules very attractive, but here I want to concentrate not so much on the thickness of the rule, but on the thickness of the subject upon whom that rule is laid. So there's no place for a thick rule if the subject of human law is so thin that they're simply defined by their subjection to it. Because otherwise, what would be the place for casuistry? So what's attractive is the early modern subject of casuistry is a thick subject. They've got interests, material interests. They're also subject to God. So they've got multiple dimensions, which means that their interface with the law is not as simple as a simple do this or do that. So, and that's the sense in which it's a site of citizenship and of agency. So what I'm calling thick subjects. Now, Daston is part of a widespread trend in recent scholarship to rescue casuistry from the infamy in which it was plunged by Blaise Pascal in the Lettres Provinciales, so it's just an excuse for sin. In a scholastic dry joke, one of the key sort of casuists of the 17th century, Antonino Diana, was called the Lamb of God because he took away the sins of the world. So this is the caricature. But in Daston's hands, and I think absolutely, casuistry represents a sophisticated response to the apparently non-negotiable demands of the law. Even in its individualized mode, it's a form of political assertion. It's a reconstruction of the interface between ruler and ruled. And I would also say that in the Thomist tradition, which is what we are concerned with, it has a kind of social conscience, if you like, because they think that even if you don't have to obey the law, you may be bound in conscience, in charity, to do so in order not to disrupt the social fabric. So it's not a kind of free-for-all. For all that, I don't think we can go back to early modern casuistry. I think that from a modern democratic point of view, the leeway that it gives for private disobedience on grounds other than conscientious objection seems incompatible both with a modern rule of law and with modern democracy. That's something we might discuss. But early moderns themselves, and we'll see more of this in the next lecture, are quite well aware elites had more resources for finessing their legal obligations, and with that their political subjection, than the lower classes, partly because a rich person is legally thicker. They've just got more property than a poor one. But that makes a difference, right? So that many more good reasons why the law would cease in their case. So I don't want to recommend that we go back to early modern casuistry, fascinating though it is, but what I really want to take away from it is this thick subject as a kind of active co-determinant of their own subjection. So going back to Francisco Suarez, with his distinction between citizens and slaves, he said that it's slavish to approach the law as if you have to obey it at all costs. The law expects you to think that you have rights against it. So the right attitude to the law is a kind of, well, really? Do I have to? And it expects you to exercise them. So this is very much that political subject of the possibility condition. So to go back to Fuller's words, and for the scholastics, at least the Suarez generation, a law that asks, quote, somewhat too much and is a bit harsh and unfair, that's politically unacceptable, however much it may conform to the other conditions of law. And as we'll see in a moment with Suarez, a whole community as well as individuals can judge that a law is too hard and can act collectively to reject it. In other words, Fuller's quotes, indeterminate area in which the internal and the external moralities of law meet, was precisely politics. And it's that that I want to turn to for this shorter, you'll be pleased to hear, third section of this lecture. Okay, so Fuller appreciated that his handling of law's inner morality begged a massive political question. So the inner morality of law, he said, is a morality of the in-group, but it doesn't actually say anything about who should be in the in-group. But he argued that the view of man's nature presupposed by law's inner morality has at least the external consequence of suggesting that no one should be excluded on the basis of race, for example. And he's writing in the mid-60s. So the list of his requirements of law that we saw, including possibility, presupposes the subject as, quotes, a responsible agent capable of understanding and following rules and answerable for his defaults. And so it's a picture of the subject as self-determining agency and human dignity. So in one dimension, Fuller's morality of law points towards the politics of human rights, and that's one direction that it has been taken in, for example, by Jeremy Waldron. How far we want to go down the road of thinking of all human rights as impossibility claims or moral impossibility claims, that's something I leave for today. I think I agree with Fuller and with Jefferson that it makes very good sense of some of them. But I would only add that if you go down that road, you do think of the subject of human rights as thicker than just having dignity or self-determining agency. Possibility is a kind of rich field, not simply personhood, I think. Anyway, that's for another day or for the discussion. So we're primarily interested, as I suggested here, in a kind of slightly lesser degree of impossibility, not something that's humanly impossible or repugnant, but this category of the too hard, a bit much. And with possible according to custom, as which is possible as much as possible according to nature. As I suggested earlier, it's very interested in people living different lives, which are differently materially articulated in terms of favoured possessions and social situation. So in other words, I think it approaches the subject of the law in a way that's comparable in many respects with how contemporary political science approaches the democratic voter. So this isn't an abstract person. This is somebody of a particular kind. So if you think about voters, they're typically thought of in a fine-grained social, economic, cultural, and political context. So it slices the electorate by class, age, ethnicity, gender, education, family, wealth, community history. All these other variables make up the thickness of the democratic voter, and political science is very interested in that kind of thickness. And it can also take an ethnographic approach, seeking to understand subjects and the way they vote from their viewpoint. What does it look like from that standpoint? I would translate as, what is the possibility of their life look like from the way that they look? And therefore, it's also very interested in the kinds of goods that are associated with that kind of possibility and what people think they would lose if they didn't have those things. So I think there's an affinity between this kind of thick subject of democratic voting and these sort of socially and materially rich scholastic understanding of the citizen subject to the possibility condition. Now, the demand for law to be as easily assimilable by the people in that sense and the corresponding respect for the subject's eye viewpoint creates an association in early modern scholasticism between the possibility condition and a question that got embedded in the early modern scholastic, whether law depends on popular acceptance, right? So is the acceptance of the people necessary in civil law for it to be perfectly established and have obligatory force? Now, Suarez very strongly takes a view that the law does not depend on popular acceptance. And he used this question to talk about democracy. So for Suarez, law is an act of will on the part of the highest political power. We might call it the sovereign. It's a sovereign act of will. So now, in a democracy, yes, the law does depend on popular acceptance, but only because the people is the lawmaker, right? They are the sovereign. It's the same thing. So kind of by definition, because they're the ones, it's the people who legislates it. But he wants to say that in any other constitution, even a mixed constitution, popular acceptance is not necessary. The law obliges if it's been passed by the relevant power and popular acceptance has no impact on its force, which may seem to run counter to other things that we've been saying about the thick subject and in Suarez. Okay, so what he seems to be saying here is, in principle, all the people can do is obey. But this turns out not to be the case. So there's an exception for an unjust law, but as Suarez says, that really isn't an exception because an unjust law is not a law. Exception two. Okay, what about a law that's not unjust, but it's too hard? So a second exception is if a law, albeit not unjust, is nevertheless too hard and grievous, and it's collectively judged so by the people of the Commonwealth. Somewhat harsh and unfair, as Fuller might put it. Now, if this is a collective judgment of the whole community, Suarez allows individual subjects to temporize, right? So it's likely, he says, that those who start not obeying it don't sin. And we have an appeal to legislative intention to save the theoretical position. I mean, surely the prince cannot have intended to put his loyal subjects under an absolute obligation to obey a law that everyone thinks is too hard. Surely he can just have been trying it out to see if they can manage it. Only testing how the people would take such a law. But then it seems, he says, that his subjects too can, with a similar intention, begin not to observe it in order not to impose a burden on themselves. Or at least, quoting from the bottom of that passage, each one of them can legitimately await what direction the community goes in and in the meantime not observe the law. Again, there's this thing, you're not expected to obey the law if it would be a really massive cost. And if you've got social support from that, because everybody thinks, well, you know, this is a bit much, then we have room to manoeuvre. Beyond that, and this is something we might want to discuss, so the third exception concerns what if the majority de facto don't obey the law? And I might as well put that slide up. So maybe it was the case that people who started not obeying the law, maybe they were sinful, but actually de facto when the majority doesn't obey the law, well, at that point it has stopped having obligatory force and it doesn't oblige the minority. Why? Because it's no longer in the interests of the common good. The prince cannot be presumed to say, well, look, you know, individuals oblige it. He's passing the law for the whole of community, but if they reject it, then the rationale of obligation ceases. So he's failed to hold that line between natural law and the common good that's kind of guarded by the possibility condition. So at that point, he's failed, like the hapless King Rex. There are some caveats on that because he realizes this is going in a bit of a democratic direction. But, but still, for an absolutist like Suarez to put this on paper is, to me, astonishing. Okay, so there's a kind of popular majoritarianism here, we might say, that operates not at the level of the constitution, but through a kind of lateral social operation between individual private subjects. So we're used to thinking of majoritarian democracy as a form of collective sovereignty, not of collective subjection. discounting those lateral relations between private individuals. But the characteristic legal gap that possibility opens up in early modern political thought, I think, is a politically creative space that gives both sovereigns and subjects time to deliberate further about what's too hard, a kind of collective temporizing. So we might kind of call it a kind of mature non-democracy, which I'll return to. Just closing now very briefly. So citizens' rights on this understanding are primarily rights against the law rather than against their governors. It involves a broadly Hobbesian thought that whatever form of government you live under, your relation to the law is the same. Even if you had a role in making the law, it might still be impossible for you. And that you would have some leeway there. So it's not a theory that thinks, oh, if the person consents to it, then it's okay, because you could consent to it, but it might still not be okay. But I do think this understanding of liberty has some implications for the nature of the vertical relationship between ruler and ruled. It depends on rulers recognizing at least the potential for a possibility gap, allowing for a subject's eye viewpoint that may not coincide with their own and may legitimately not coincide. So I think possibility as a condition of law necessarily implies some kind of mutual agency between somewhat the person doing the legislating and the person on the receiving end of that. And I'll pursue that further in the next lecture when we look at cases where that's not the case. Finally, possibility, just to recommend, as a mark of political government, it doesn't correspond to all our intuitions, for sure not. It's early modern and deeply reactionary in some ways. But I leave you with the thought that maybe there's a case to be made for recovering possibility in this rich social sense as an interface between what Fuller called the internal and the external morality of law, or in Thomist terms, holding the line between the demands of natural law and the specific questions of legislating for a community. Possibility is a language that can be shared between legislators and subjects, one that doesn't precisely reduce to practicable. So when a subject protests the impossibility of a law, they're not protesting that it's not practicable to them, for them. They're saying it's not possible for them. But it's too hard, it drives them into a corner, or at least it disrupts their life in certain fundamental ways that goes against their attachments. So it's broadly a non-judgmental language that's democratically available to people of all social statuses to articulate and to protest what they don't think they can reconcile with their current way of life and self-understanding. And in turn, it asks legislators to enter into the worlds of very different kinds of subjects and see what it looks like from there. Thank you.
So while you've just heard the lecture, let me recap very briefly some of its key ideas. So in contexts ranging from scholasticism to the common law, including the wonderful category of Calvinist Thomism, the lecture recovers moral possibility as a language that can be shared between legislators and subjects, and that can be particularly adapted from the subject's eye viewpoint that characterizes all politics, and particularly democratic politics. So moral possibility marks moments in which, because it would be tyrannical to require subjects to act in a certain way for more than a short time, the law cannot or should not demand that they do so, and they are free to resist such a demand should it be made. As such, Professor Brett argues, the concept marks a site of negotiation in which, while its potentially reactionary instantiations must be acknowledged, both freedom and democracy might take root. This argument opens up new vistas in the history of law, moral philosophy, and political theory, and it is truly an honor to be here to witness and assist at its birth. So I'm going to focus my comments today on the contours of the landscape of moral possibility and impossibility. And I'll build throughout on Professor Brett's insight that moral possibility is not simply a matter of a fixed or universal human nature, but of the second nature that is molded by customs and habits of social life, as well as by individual dispositions and experiences. So the first half of my comments will be more in the matter of review of the different categories of moral possibility, and I'll comment on some of these and ask how Professor Brett might further differentiate the implications of these different categories. The second half will explore how far lawgivers might be able to transform those contours instead of simply yielding before them. And here I'll reconsider Professor Brett's readings of Solonian Athens and Lycurgan Sparta, including one challenge to what she, or at least her sources, make of Plutarch and on Lycurgus and the Spartan boy, in order to advance this question of the lawgiver's standpoint. So as you heard, Professor Brett introduces the important subject's eye standpoint. My own current work has been on the lawgiver's standpoint. And so in this these comments, that's what I'll focus on. So to begin with the first half of the agenda as to how the landscape of moral possibility is differentiated, and let me say here how fascinated I was to read her discussion of Solon and Fuller in a single lecture, as I have in my own recent work been comparing Fuller's desiderata for the internal morality of law to the ways that Solon is depicted as Athenian lawgiver, and I'll come back to that later on. So I'm going to start with Fuller's own categories, rather the examples that he gives when he introduces the category of possibility in the context of the Rex parable. I apologize, this is slightly small print. And I've given these labels to the categories. As you see, they're quite close to some of the labels that Professor Brett used in presenting. She referred to physical, natural, psychological, psychosocial, customary, different kinds of possibility. But I wanted to regiment them a bit and also to point out that in one paragraph, Fuller actually refers to the first three and then several pages later adds the last two. So let me just very briefly run through these. So first of all, Fuller begins with physical impossibility. Previously, the citizens had 10 days to report. Now they have only 10 seconds. That's a kind of physical impossibility. Physiological impossibility, I'm going to say a bit more about this. It was made a crime punishable by imprisonment to cough, sneeze, hiccup, faint, or fall down in the presence of the king. Cognitive impossibility, it was made treason not to understand, believe in, and correctly profess a certain doctrine. And then later on, he adds these two others. One is really strict liability, and Fuller says this is really not impossible. The whole point of strict liability is that it's not impossible that adequate care should be taken. And then finally, customary impossibility, and Fuller refers to these, our notions about impossibility and possibility are subject to historical change. Now, I want to, first of all, then ask Professor Brett to say more about how this kind of differentiation is important for her argument. Are all five of these, in fact, cases of moral possibility or impossibility? And what difference does it make whether one or the other of these kinds is invoked? So I just want to develop a bit further, in particular, the physiological and also the cognitive. So the physiological, I think, is especially interesting. Wait, before those are such great quotes, let me first of all introduce them. The physiological, I think, is especially interesting because physiological responses, like Fuller's coughing, sneezing, hiccuping, laughing, perhaps, are shaped by custom, but they're not reducible to beliefs, and yet they're not consciously chosen as actions. And so here, for example, is an illustration from Rousseau, who writes in the letter to D'Alembert, the laws cannot force the public to enjoy plays in the theater. And he recounts, the emperor Nero sang at the theater and had all those who fell asleep put to death. Still, he could not keep everybody awake. So here is a case of moral impossibility, not for reasons of jet lag or torture, but boredom, which kind of leads to sleepiness as a partly involuntary physiological response. Now, the second example from the same letter is kind of liminal between physiology and belief, and this is belief about what is honorable or contemptible. So Rousseau is here discussing the establishment in his day in France of a tribunal that was attempting to change public opinion about duels. And Rousseau remarks there that even the law cannot oblige anyone to dishonor himself. If the whole people has judged that a man is a poltroon, the king can declare him brave all he wishes, and no one will believe a bit of it. So I would like to hear a bit more about how the operation of honor and dishonor as evaluative attitudes function in respect of moral possibility. Let me also say a little bit now about the physiological in Suarez, the example of fasting. So as we heard, Suarez reads the example of a fast in bread and water for the whole of Lent as an example of moral impossibility. It could not be done by most people without great difficulty. But it seems to me that we need to consider that many people do succeed in that kind of demanding fasting over long periods of time. And in those contexts, often custom is working to support their achievement of that as possible. So for example, consider those who observe Passover or Ramadan, for example, which are relatively short periods, shorter than Lent. But those who also observe Jewish or Muslim or other dietary laws continuously without ever succumbing to a cheeseburger or a bacon sandwich. So in other words, compliance with fasting is not just a matter of physiological willpower, but rather of agency that might be positively reinforced by custom. Or if we recall Amartya Sen's example of a protest fast, a hunger strike, of course it might be reinforced by other beliefs or commitments. And so finally, I just wanted to come back to the question about the difference between the legal compulsion of beliefs and the legal compulsion of actions. And this is the quotation from Jefferson that is found in Fuller, as we saw in the lecture. Now, of course, the distinction between law compelling actions as possible versus compelling beliefs is a hoary distinction. It's one with which Professor Brett and her characters are, of course, deeply familiar. But I would like to hear her say something more about how the distinction between the different kinds of moral possibility and impossibility involved in beliefs and in actions might affect her overall account. So I've sought in this first half of my comments to point out some more fine-grained contours in the landscape of moral possibility. But I now want to turn to the second half of the comments, which is to take up the standpoint of the lawgiver or legislator to ask whether there's more scope for the legislator to reshape the contours of moral possibility than perhaps the lecture allowed or at least discussed. And so to look at this, I want to take up two figures that in different ways featured in the lecture. On the one hand, Solon, the lawgiver of Athens, and on the other hand, Lycurgus. So on at least one reading of Plutarch, Solon is an example of a lawgiver who temporizes, as it were, with moral impossibility, as I'll show. But Lycurgus, on the other hand, as I want to argue, is a kind of limiting case for the ancients and the early moderns. He is a legislator who did not temporize with moral impossibility, but rather profoundly transformed it. So that's what I'll now argue. So let me begin with the anecdote about anger that Professor Brett took from Plutarch's Life of Solon. And what I want to point out here is the context of the actual laws of Solon to which the explanation about moral impossibility is appended. So what Solon actually did was to make laws which forbid speaking ill of the dead and speaking ill of the living on the pain of a penalty of paying a certain amount of money to the person injured and to the public treasury. Now, it's in that context that Plutarch remarks that Solon was aware that for most people it's impossible to control their, most people can control their anger, but a few people can't, and so those people need the laws to make them do so. So what I want to point out here is that actually in this case, the moral impossibility is not preventing the establishment or the operation of the laws. What the moral impossibility does is actually to show why we need the laws and why we need to enforce them, rather than showing that we can't make them or shouldn't make or enforce them. Now, I think that elsewhere in the life of Solon, there are two other passages that might, I think, better illustrate the point of moral possibility than this case, at least insofar as it's meant to serve as a break on the laws. So in the left-hand box, you see another passage from the life of Solon, but it's discussing the Sicilian tyrant, Dionysius. And I won't read it all, but the point is that Dionysius is here saying that he couldn't make a law about giving someone in marriage where age would make it sort of naturally repugnant because of such a great difference in age. So that, I think, is maybe a better case, where here the moral impossibility is serving on a break, as in a break on the law, whereas in the case of the anger laws, it's not. Now, you might also think that this general remark in the right-hand text box is a good illustration of the overall point. And this is a kind of interesting overall analysis of Solon in the biography. And it says, when at a later date Solon was asked whether he had provided the best laws for the Athenians, his reply was, the best that they would accept. And the verb prosdeximai is in the middle voice, and as the scholar Jill Frank has put it, with the middle voice, we find the speakers and listeners acting as agents of their own persuasion. Now, what's interesting about this is that you might read this as a kind of temporizing. This might be they'll only accept the laws going so far, they won't go further. But I think there's also a kind of more positive dimension to the agency here. The subjects have to accept the laws kind of actively. And actually, in another passage of the Solon here, which is actually what I chose when I was trying to illustrate Rex and Solon kind of fitting together, Fuller's categories with Solon, I chose this passage. And there's another passage, in fact, which illustrates another one of Fuller's desiderata, which emphasizes the citizens' agency, that in Solon's Athens, the citizens should be the agents of punishment. So I think here we see the germ of a kind of more optimistic case, where the citizens themselves can reshape the boundaries of moral possibility, rather than just being stopped short by them or simply temporizing. And just for fun, this was when I was myself previously working on Fuller and Solon, this was the way in which I saw each of Fuller's categories being illustrated in texts that we have about Solon. Okay, now, I've been suggesting that Solon might as lawgiver have reckoned with the agency of citizens, not simply succumbed to existing boundaries of moral possibility. But for some later readers, such as the 18th century Abbé Mably, Solon was dramatically inferior to Lycurgus. So Mably reflects on that very same passage about the best they would accept much more pessimistically. So he says, the laws Solon gave to the Athenians were but superficial, pretending that they were not capable of better laws. And Mably draws that distinction by saying, by contrast, Lycurgus, as the lawgiver of Sparta, effected a much more profound and uncompromising root and branch reform of Spartan passions and morals. And so this brings me finally to Lycurgus, and here I am going to offer a disagreement with Professor Brett in one respect. And this is how we should understand the anecdote about the Spartan boy that she discussed Gentili as having taken from Philo. And the reason that this is important is that what I want to argue is that this anecdote does not mark a moral impossibility in the case of the Spartan boy, but rather it shows us how the laws of Lycurgus made much possible for Spartans that would be impossible for everyone else. So in other words, the Spartan boy properly understood, I think, is showing us how Lycurgus' lawgiver was able to transform the contours of moral impossibility. And so this is nearly my final point. So in setting up her account, Professor Brett, as you heard, presents this story about the Spartan boy. And let me just quote her words again. She says, "Slavery means that you can legally be forced to do what is repugnant to your inclinations. The possibility condition does not apply. Notice the classic response to such a command, despair. The Spartan boy kills himself." But is despair the right way to gloss this story? Again, sorry for the small print, but I'll read it for you as we need to see it. So here's the Philo. This is the passage from which Gentili took the story. And what it says is that the Spartan boy was carried off as a prisoner. He refused to submit to menial offices, saying he was not going to be a slave. And then it says, even though he's young, he wasn't yet thoroughly educated in the laws of Lycurgus. He'd only tasted them. But he was educated enough in these Spartan laws to judge a violent death preferable to the slavish life which was before him. There is a mention of despair, here despairing of any deliverance, but the end is he cheerfully slew himself. Now, this account of the boy's suicide does not read to me as an expression of despair, even though you see the word despair in the passage. Rather, what's remarkable about this youth is his indomitable spirit. He kills himself cheerfully, and where laws are featuring in this story is actually on the side of the boy's resistance. It's not that it's impossible for him to obey, and so he sort of despairs and kills himself. It's rather having tasted the laws of Lycurgus that he finds the moral possibility to summon up the virtue to resist enslavement. So the point of the story, as I read it, is not that the boy was resisting something that was just too hard for him to do, but rather he was choosing not to comply. He was actively committing suicide in order to avoid enslavement. So he's an example not of moral impossibility, but of a kind of exceptional moral capacity in this rather harsh and disturbing context of the story. Okay, so I have a little bit more about Gentili that I think I'm going to skip, but what I want to emphasize is that I would read the Spartan boy's resistance as an agency asserting choice, which is made possible by the profound effect of the lawgiver in having reshaped the contours of human possibility. Now, I don't think this is just an issue of how to read the Spartan boy or even how to read the case of Sparta. I think it's really a fundamental question of the relationship between mores and laws and the direction of travel and fit between them. So this issue is both deep and vexed. It's sometimes stylized, as by a recent scholar on Rousseau, Flora Champy, arguing that Montesquieu would have said that laws must be built on mores, so mores lead to laws. And in her work on Rousseau, she says, no, but for Rousseau, laws lead to mores. It's actually a bit more complex than that in Rousseau. There are moments in the Political Fragments, for example, where it looks like mores lead to laws, which lead to mores. So, for example, Rousseau writes there, if sometimes the laws influence morals, it is when the laws draw their force from them. And so in any case, we could say much more about Rousseau on this, but I would be very interested to hear Professor Brett say more about how she conceives the relationship between laws and mores or customs. In the lecture, and notwithstanding the very interesting discussion of thick rules and thick agency and possibility, I think that the way laws work was generally presented as a kind of frontal attack on a given custom. So the laws that were being considered were those that might issue a simple prohibition on an ingrained custom that will run up against individual or collective resistance. But I think that there are other ways that lawgivers can function to reshape customs, including other ways that they can use laws to do so. And so I want to close by beginning to illustrate this point with a passage from Plutarch's Lycurgus. So here, Plutarch remarks that Lycurgus undertook to divide up the Spartans' movable property, but he saw that they could not bear to have it taken from them directly. And I forgot to check the Greek verb again there, but there's a wonderful verb in Greek, which is sort of people can't stomach it. And I think it may be that verb. They just couldn't stomach it. So he took another course, and he overcame their avarice by political devices. He withdrew gold and silver money and ordained the use of iron money only. Now here, Lycurgus sees the moral impossibility that would resist a frontal and direct legal attack. But instead of deferring to the existing contours of moral impossibility, he took another course by using political devices. So here the lawgiver uses political devices to transform the contours of the landscape of moral possibility. And I want to say more about how this might work. I will do so in my comments that will help to open the seminar discussion on Thursday. But for now, let me once again thank and congratulate Professor Brett for today's scintillating lecture.
Many papers generated by Melissa's really rich and wonderful comments. So let me, I won't take long because I think it's important that other people have a chance to speak. I think I'm just going to, I'm going to do it in reverse. I'll make 3 points. Right, Lycurgus and the difference between Solon and Lycurgus. And yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, Plutarch's own, I mean, you'd be more expert on this one, but Plutarch's own presentation is that Lycurgus did a better job than Solon. And there's a big tradition of admiring Sparta in European political thought. I'm not on that wing. The point about Solon, he's legislating for a democracy. So I will say some more about upping what I'm calling possibility thresholds. Next lecture, that's virtue. And there's this question about whether an individual can lift their own possibility. And as I say, in this scholastic tradition, there are moments when, where the common good is really at stake, it can ask its situations to come up with more. Right, so it's not saying we always have to legislate down. So I really want to, but it's a really rich interface between possibility and virtue. Possibility, it's like virtue is the flip side. And a lawgiver is working on that interface. And I totally agree there are lots of ways that a lawgiver can do that and different ways in which the subjects can respond. So I'll have a look at that in concrete contexts tomorrow. So, yeah, so, for the present, all I'll say is, well, you know, yes, exactly. So people can't bear to have, you know, I mean, their property, you know, that is morally impossible. That's my stuff. And so he finds a way around it. But is that democratic, right? That's the question. Is it democratically okay to not hit people with a law and give them a chance to accept or not accept it, but to kind of work it a way around it so that they get transformed despite themselves? That's not a question that I'm just throwing that out to everybody. I mean, there's quite a lot of coincidence between thinking about moral possibility and the kind of way of political thinking that was really initiated by Cass Sunstein with nudging. And so this kind of policy where you sort of encourage, you're kind of encouraging, you're making stuff a little bit easier for them. And so it's not to say that that's inconsistent with democracy, but you might want to argue that there's a lack of transparency there that is actually fundamentally not democratic. I think this is a question that we can throw. I mean, I'm really delighted that you raised that. We can think about that. Okay, so that's the one thing, that Lycurgus is not a legislator for a democracy, Solon is. And I think that's why he's very interesting to the early moderns, who are not, most of the time, terrifically fond of democracy. But they do think that there is this something about this possibility demand. Yeah, I'll go back to it. Yeah. So another thing, so this example about, the particular example that Professor Lane doesn't think is necessarily the most apt one. So that's the one that they pick up. That is the key quote, the bit about restraining anger. So if you're a humanist or maybe you're a Protestant, you don't really want to buy into moral possibility. It's a deeply Catholic concept. But you still, there is this tradition of thinking about it, so you're likely to refer to that. And that's the marker that they use. And I think it's the marker for something that I didn't really emphasize enough, but it's there in the way that they construct Exodus. It's not just a matter of commanding the impossible, it's about punishing people if they don't come up with it. And that interestingly resonates with Fuller, because he does discuss the example of, for example, a school teacher might set students something they really can't do. But that could be quite positive. But it's because he's not going to punish them at the end of it, so they're not like reduced to jelly. So you can, and that's like a pedagogic legislator. Again, it's not democratic because the people are children in respect to the legislator, right? They're not being treated as an adult. So it's the question of punishment is at least part of the difference, and that's the context that it comes up in Hugo Grotius, for example. It's in Book 2, Chapter 20, the key chapter on punishment, where he's discussing whether venial sins and small sins, everyday sins, should be punished, and he says, "Well, no, actually." Quote from the Solon. And then he goes on to sort of outrage everybody by saying, well, maybe they're not even sins at all. Because, considered collectively, they seem to lack a liberty that sin seems to require. If everybody does it, well, yeah. So anyway, so that's Grotius deliberately flirting on the borderline, but that's where he quotes the Solon quote, and it's in the context of punishment. So I think I should have perhaps emphasized that a little bit more in my lecture. Yes, so the Gentili. So here, I mean, I don't think... let's see if I can find it on my slides. I really appreciate Professor Lane's kind of construction of this, of the original quote and what lies behind that. I don't think Gentili leaves that quote alone. So it's a difficult passage. Gentili is a very difficult author, and it's difficult to read intentionality. But one thing we might say is that although the Spartan boy killed himself cheerfully, Gentili just says he killed himself. So we leave out the cheerfully. And so here he talks about this exploit of the Spartan boy, and it's unclear how we're supposed to read it. But then he goes on to say, well, Hercules, though, let me see if I can find that quote. Sorry, I'm not good with these things. I'll just have to recount it. He says, well, look, Hercules, he bore with this, right? Because that's what a slave has to do. And they can't be thinking of sort of, making a nice distinction between, oh, that's liberal and I'll do it, and that's not, and I won't, because it's not their place to do it, right? Let them not think of liberal things or free things when they're not actually free themselves. And that picking up that language of liberalia throws it back on the anecdote. And so I think it's really bitter and hard what Gentili is saying there. And, the adjective they use to describe slavery is hard, dura ser, it's hard. There's something really bitter about this. And I think that Gentili captures what's going on there. So it might be a sort of pejorative concept. This Spartan boy, right, he just killed himself. Whereas Heracles, he managed it. So maybe the Spartans weren't such heroes after all. So I do think that's the way I used it. I think I was too quick to associate it with despair, which is a marker of impossibility, and we'll see another example in tomorrow's lecture. So I absolutely take the correction there, but I feel that, Yeah, as it's being read in the early modern context, it doesn't... Gentili is transforming it by the way that he puts it into his text. But he's quite presuming that you will know the original sense, and it has its valence from there. So I think it's, you know, you put that sense back in, which I haven't done. So I absolutely take that point. Good. I'm going to leave it there.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for some questions from the audience. We'll begin with Daniel.
Thanks for these really interesting insights. I had a question about the basic framing that you offer, which is really focused on a bilateral relation between the lawmaker and the subject. And within that bilateral relation, the emphasis on possibility has a sort of accommodating and sort of generous, tolerant dimension to it, right? The sense that we are, you know, protecting people from overly demanding laws. I'm wondering how that picture changes once we think about the law in a tripartite sense and introduce people who need to be protected from the actions of others. So when we start to think that laws in part function to limit what some people can do to other people, where suddenly being so accommodating of those who are barred from treating other people in certain ways might no longer look as liberal. And the obvious context where this comes up is when you think of, say, anti-discrimination law and demands or, you know, hopes for religious exemption. Because there's a very natural way of framing a lot of what you're discussing here in exactly the terms that people use when they try to explain why they should be permitted to engage in various forms of discrimination, right? And I wonder whether that part of the story, the role the law plays in protecting people, just isn't part of the story as you're currently telling it. It might not be part of the story as, you know, people were thinking about it back then, but I'm wondering just how you think the story might run differently if we frame that, if you will, more centrally.
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question, and this is why I wanted to not present this way of thinking as necessarily liberal or progressive at all. I think it can be completely the opposite. So I have two answers, I think. So I suggested in this kind of Thomist way of thinking that possibility occupies a kind of center ground. It's like a modulating frame between natural law on the one hand and the common good on the other. So I think that when we're talking about anti-discrimination, right, if we're talking about basic protections for basic rights, given the possibility condition, you can't say, oh, we're going to accommodate you even though it's against natural law, because all law has to be in accordance with natural law, right? So you could see a kind of protection against explicit injustice built into the fact that the law, it can't bend over backwards infinitely, because if you start bending over backwards too far, well, then you've lost any congruence with natural law. It's like a limit case, and I think that anti-discrimination laws would be like that, although modern anti-discrimination laws have a much richer sense of that than a kind of basic natural law morality. So I don't think that possibility, I don't think it's true for these people that it's infinitely bending down. It's not, because there's a limit on how far you can actually bend down. If there weren't, then it could just be indulging any kinds of prejudices. But I think, what's interesting to me about this is that, we've just got to religious difference, social difference, and the kind of psychological differences in psychology that go with that are inherent to a modern democracy. And I think one of the things about the early modern society is it's deeply divided. It's socially. And so how can it be? We resist it because we think, you can't preserve this protection for aristocrats never to sort of get their hands dirty consistently with social justice. And in the next lecture, I will talk about that in colonial Peru. But on the other hand, a way of thinking that does not just thinks that just expects people to overcome things that are deeply repugnant to them, when we might not sympathize with why it's repugnant to them, but it is. And I think, I mean, particularly, I mean, this is a point that's been made, and particularly, in UK, let's stick to UK politics, but post-Brexit, there's deep divisions and deep misunderstanding, and we're not really going to get any further as a community without understanding why some people might think in that way. So I think, I mean, what part of what interests me in moral possibility is this notion about repugnance and psychological repugnance, and things that people and people's kind of like red lines. I think it helps to capture some of that as a political phenomenon, as a sort of response to legislation. So it's not that I'm recommending we go back to this, I'm absolutely not, but just suggest I think it's resonant in the politics of division. Let me do it with that.
Thank you both. Great lecture, great comment. I wanted to ask about the notion of moral possibility and how it relates to psychological possibility. So towards the beginning of the lecture, you suggested that moral possibility has a kind of component of temporality. So something could be psychologically possible for you, but it could still be morally impossible because you can't keep it up over a long period of time. But if that's right, I had two questions. The first is, why isn't moral possibility just a form of psychological possibility? So what role is the temporality playing there to make it a different kind of possibility? And if it is a different kind of possibility. And the second, it's just terminological. Can you say what the significance of the word moral is? Are we supposed to be thinking of mores or what? So thank you.
Yes, so I think so it is a kind of psychological possibility or impossibility, and just in the sense of, you know, so for example, what you would need to up your possibility threshold was virtue, which is an inner disposition of your soul. So I think it is psychological. But what's interesting about moral possibility is that it's not just what you can do in an instant, it's actually over. And I think that's really important for thinking, because people don't live their lives from moment to moment, nor are they legislated for from moment to moment. It's kind of what you can manage over. So I think that's a politically interesting concept, because, you know, you could legislate, you know, you could, if you didn't take into account moral possibility, you could legislate anything that was psychologically possible. But in fact, the law would fail on this thing. It would fail the possibility condition, because actually then people are going to collapse. And it's actually part of this idea that this way of legislating is that you're not supposed to create fault or sin by legislating in such a way that people, although they managed it on Thursday, by the time it's got to Monday, they're not doing it. So this is the idea that the law should not be like a trap or a snare for people. And I think that this comes out in Hobbes. I mean, this idea that it shouldn't be a snare. There shouldn't be too many laws in the first place. That's part of this possibility thinking. So that what you're trying to get the law to do is to... it's not a kind of completely smooth path. It's not an indulgence to vice. I think it's really important to say that that's not the case. But it's something that people can manage. And I think that, because what they think is that if you fail the whole time, you will start despairing. So I'm going a bit beyond them here. But to succeed is in obeying the law, for laws to be possible, is actually psychologically, I would say, reinforcing. whereas having a really high barrier and but then failing it, that is demoralizing. And if we sort of put this at a political level, then we sort of multiply that. So that's what I would say. Yes, morally impossible. So this is a very interesting concept because it's got this kind of sandwich effect. The great Bible on this is written by a German scholar called Sven Nebel, and it's about 500 pages long because it's a really complicated concept. So Nebel, so there are these two elements. One, it's too hard. Two, it's impossible to keep up over a run of time or over the run of a population. So these can split apart. So we do get a sense of moral possibility that's purely statistical, which is the one that he's really interested in because it feeds into probability. I'm less interested in that because I think I'm more interested in politics of it. And I think the difficulty component is key to this question of legislating. But still it adds something to just psychology because it has this idea you're legislating for a whole population. The common good is the whole population. There's a further question, which is about the relationship between moral in the sense of like morally good and moral in the sense of mores, habits, dispositions. And we do get it used in the early modern period in that sense of what's morally good, right and wrong. And so Nebel calls this a deontic sense. I'm not sure that's the right word, but you know, it's more something that you should do from a moral point of view. So one thing I think that's really interesting about these theorists is that they're sometimes you would just get an interface between the two. So like suicide is the extreme example. So suicide is deeply morally repugnant, right? Your every inclination and probably your social culture also, everything tells you not to commit suicide. So it's morally impossible in that sense. But it's also morally wrong. And this is because of this distinctive Thomist theory of natural law in which the natural inclinations and the commands of natural law dovetail so tightly. So you're not necessarily going to get a hard and fast line between what's morally wrong in our standard sense of moral is right and wrong, and what's morally wrong in the sense of repugnant to most people can't manage it. And sometimes we find it sliding around between those two, or we get arguments that the one kind of the repugnance thing actually folds back into commands of natural law. Yeah, precisely because of this relationship that I've been talking about. Does that answer your question?
Let's thank Annabel Brett and Melissa Lane.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.